What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Nicholas Meyer. Nicholas Meyer is an award-winning author, screenwriter, and director. His body of creative work in publishing, film, and television spans more than five decades. He is the author of seven novels, including The 7% Solution, which was published in 1975, which deals with Sherlock Holmes meeting Sigmund Freud. The novel sold more than 2 million copies, stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 40 weeks, and won the British Gold Dagger Award for the British Crime Writers Association. 2 years later, Meyer received an Academy Award nomination for his screenplay on the film, which starred, among others, Sir Laurence Olivier, Robert Duvall, and Alan Arkin. Meyer made his directing debut in 1979 with the film he wrote, Time After Time, starring Malcolm McDowell and Mary Steenburgen. He went on to direct Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Other directing credits include Volunteers with Tom Hanks, The Deceivers with Pierce Brosnan, and the HBO film Vendetta with Christopher Walken. His screenplays include, among others, The Prince of Egypt. Meyer directed ABC's The Day After in 1983, which remains the single most-watched television film ever made. 100 million people tuned in that night to watch the film, and was nominated for 14 Emmys. I spoke with him for about an hour, and I really hope you enjoy. And now I give you Nicholas Meyer. Okay, I'm here with Nicholas Meyer. Nick, thank you for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. I'm very excited to be here.
No, it was my pleasure.
It's both of our mutual pleasures, right?
Okay. So
I want to discuss your screenwriting career. I want to discuss directing. I want to discuss your books. Before we get there, could you please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do?
I'm a writer, director, novelist, storyteller, filmmaker, like that.
Perfect. Easy enough. So winding the clock back then, Nick, I'd love to know, when did you become interested in writing and what did you do to foster a career in it?
I started writing before I was 5 years old. I would dictate little stories to my father, who would write them down. And they were epics, like how our dog carried the newspaper home from the grocery store in his mouth, things like that. And then my father, you know, when I was somewhere, maybe six, said, "See here, I'm tired of being your stenographer. You should learn to write your own stories." And so I sort of began from there. He also said that writers and artists learn by imitating. He said, you know, when you want to become an artist, they put you in the Louvre in front of the Mona Lisa and you copy. So that's a good place to start. And at some point when I was about 11, he gave me the complete Sherlock Holmes stories. And I had a religious experience. I was Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, struck blind. I think childhood experiences with people, with scenery, with art are sometimes the ones that are most deeply imprinted. You ask people, you know, when they first saw Bambi, things like that. And those things somehow really, it's a form of imprinting, I think. Anyway, so I, you know, something like that. I never decided to become a writer. It was just something that I always did. Words were my safe place. And I was intoxicated by the English language and have remained so.
Yeah. No, that's excellent to hear, Nick. Thank you. Were there any, I have my own sort of writing inspirations and people I look up to. Did you have any mentors, isn't the word, but any inspirations that you saw early on?
Well, Lewis Carroll, James Thurber, The 13 Clocks. It's interesting that you ask about influences, because preparing to give a talk at the House of Commons, no less, in January, And the subject of my talk is called Under the Influence, and trying to establish to the degree that it's possible what has influenced one. Because influences fall into two categories. The conscious influences, the ones you're aware of, that you can cite. Yes, when I saw 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the Walt Disney movie, when I read The Three Musketeers. Yes, these are things you're aware of at the time. But then there's a whole host, a lifetime of experiences that you have absorbed that have affected your work, your conduct, your psyche, that you are, it's very hard for you to pinpoint all of them because there are so many. They are so varied.
Mm.
Is it a story that you can't get out of your head? Or is it the laugh of the kid in third grade next to you that, you know, you find yourself imitating that laugh, as I think I did fourth grade? And things that stay with you, but you're not even aware. And how many times have you in your life been in an experience that you say, oh, I will never forget this as long as I live. This is like the most momentous day of my life. And then you forget it. It doesn't stay with you. And something else that is so inconsequential, so trivial, so unimportant that it doesn't even occur to you to remember it. And yet, you never forget it. You come back to it. You replay it at odd moments, or you don't remember it, but it has affected your conduct, your work. Influences are very tricky. You can name the conscious ones. They go on and on and on.
Sure.
Bizet's Carmen. I heard it when I was 5 years old, and it remains in a way the touchstone. My discovery when I was about, 15, maybe, of Shakespeare. And I remember as if it were yesterday, I had a kind of a man crush on an actor named Laurence Olivier.
Yes.
And I was crazy about Laurence Olivier, again, because I had seen a movie when I was the first movie I ever saw. So I like bonded with this relatively obscure film. And I was about 7 when I saw it. And then I'm 15 and I see that Laurence Olivier is in a movie, the name of which is Henry V. That's what I thought the V was V. I didn't get it. It was Henry V.
Right.
And it never said Shakespeare. It just showed pictures of horses and guys in armor with sword and stuff. And I said, great, I'm doing that. And so I snuck out of school where I was a terrible student and went down to this revival cinema on the West Side in New York. And I saw this Henry V movie. And I had, they'd made us read Shakespeare in school. I didn't get it. And I found out it's not meant to be read. It's meant to be heard.
Mm.
It's meant to be seen. And I sat there until this theater closed midnight. You know, I watched this movie, must have been, 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
Starting at 3 in the afternoon. And my life was changed. I thought, okay, this guy's the best actor. This is the best movie. And whoever wrote it is the best writer. And that has just stayed with me forever. I've added to my passions, but I don't think I've subtracted many from them. I figured out Mozart when I was 5 years old. I grew up in a privileged household. My mother was a concert pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard this stuff. And I soaked it all up like a sponge, and I'm still doing that.
Wow. That's fantastic, Nick. No, thank you so much. You delved into it a little bit there, Nick, but I do love discussing the creative process. In another interview, you said that you write and make movies and books for people who read. And I was wondering if you might be able to elaborate on that a little bit.
I don't know that I can, but what's interesting is that do people read? Do they still read? Or are we in a post-literate world where we're using emojis in place of words? And I think that a lot of my points of reference are either literary, musical, or cinematic. I've seen a gazillion movies, and I have a pretty good memory. And the nice thing about movies and books, or music for that matter, is you can read, watch, hear them again and again and again. And the lyrics of musicals stay in my head, or Gilbert and Sullivan, or lines and moments from movies that just won't let me go. And I think a lot of those are culled from or relate to words that are written.
Mm.
I think I do a lot of reading, and I'm a slow reader. I read slowly because if I find a word I like, then I kind of have to stare at it and go, oh, this is cool. I like this word. I'm going to write this word down because I'll use it someplace, I hope. Things like that.
That's funny. I must be doing something right because I have a similar habit. I'd love to know, what was it that prompted you to carry on the Sherlock Holmes series?
Well, that's a very involved question. I am certainly not the first person who got to the end of Arthur Conan Doyle's 60 Sherlock Holmes stories and was dismayed that there weren't any more. Well, there was a cartoon years and years ago of a small boy in bed looking at the book that said The Final Problem with a look of complete dismay on his face. And underneath, the caption was Life's Darkest Hour. So the impetus to continue the stories certainly preceded me. There's like 400 Sherlock Holmes movies or some staggering sum. And there were other Sherlockian imitations before mine, the 7% solution, which I think is probably rightly credited with having kicked off an enormous Sherlock Holmes revival starting in 1974, from which we have yet to recover. There's now Sherlock Holmes everywhere.
Right.
You know, I sort of had the feel to myself when I published that novel. Now, if I were to read all the other Sherlock Holmes books about his daughter, his niece, his father, his sister, whatever, you would never, you know, in the lifetime left to me, I'll never get through it. But one of the other impeti was the fact that I didn't like many Sherlock Holmes imitations. Mm. I didn't like the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce movies. I sort of don't like Sherlock Holmes on film. I like him in the original Arthur Conan Doyle stories. We're now going back to the issue of reading and readers. And I like them on the page. And I was very annoyed at seeing Watson being played so broadly as a buffoon by Nigel Bruce. I didn't understand why a genius hangs out with an idiot or a jerk or whatever you want to call him. And I never believed that Watson was the voice that wrote the stories, because Watson is the narrator.
Right.
So one of the impeti for writing the 7% solution, I've now written, I think, 5 of them, and I didn't plan it that way. It just worked out. But one of the motives for writing was, I know how to do this more authentically. This Watson is all wrong in the movies and I'm going to fix it. And I was about 27 years old or something like that, and filled with a sort of youthful arrogance that I alone, could do this. And then I found out it was true. anyways, that was sort of what I was. The other part of it, the long answer, is that when I was in high school, people would say, oh, your old man's a shrink. Is he a Freudian? And I didn't know. So I said, Papa, are you a Freudian? And he said, well, it's a sort of a silly question. I said, why is it silly? And he said, because it's no more possible to discuss the history of psychoanalysis. Well, what I was saying was, I said to my dad, was trying to explain to me that to suppose that nothing has happened since Freud is like saying nothing's happened since Columbus. He was comparing in a way, which is not a bad comparison. He said, listen, when a patient comes to see me, I listen to what they say. I listen to how they say it. I try to hear what they don't say. I'm looking at how they're dressed. Are they on time? What's their body language? I am, in short, searching for clues from them as to why they are not happy. And so to me, that sounds like detective work. And he said, well, it is like detective work in a way. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder how much Arthur Conan Doyle knew of the life and writing of Sigmund Freud. And the first thing that occurs to me is, oh, they're both doctors. And they both died in the same town within 9 years of each other.
Hmm.
We know that Freud loved Sherlock Holmes. That was his bedtime.
Right.
He loved the Sherlock Holmes stories. And then I remember that, yes, Sherlock Holmes is a cocaine addict. And so for a time, Sigmund Freud was a cocaine user. He used it for depression, to treat his depression. But he became familiar with it when he worked with two eye doctors named Koenigstein and Kurler on the uses of cocaine as an anesthetic during eye surgery. Then I learned that Arthur Conan Doyle studied ophthalmology in Vienna for 6 months. And I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And out of these disparate coincidences or overlaps or elements, eventually gelled this idea of Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud. And that was the genesis over about 10 years, because I am not the sharpest knife in the drawer. So it took a while to dream up the 7% solution. By this time, I was in Los Angeles writing movies, and the Writers Guild went on strike, as we sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime in the early 2000s, I guess, we went on strike. And since there were no scripted shows, they started reality TV.
Aha, uh-huh. I see.
And that was The Apprentice. So, yeah, blame us. Law of unintended consequences.
Thank you, Nick. That's an extremely cool story. Thank you for telling it. So, yeah, so the book, 7% Solution, it was adapted into a film. It was released back in 1976 and has, of all people, Sir Laurence Olivier in it. And I'd love to know, two-part question. What was the experience of having something that you created turn into a film like? And I'd love to know what it was like working with Sir Laurence Olivier.
Well, I should say up front, I did not direct the movie. I wrote the screenplay.
Right.
I sold the book. The book, why did the book get made into a movie anyway? The 7% Solution was the number one best-selling novel in the United States for a time. And suddenly I was lifted from obscurity to my 15 minutes of notoriety. And because it was such a hit, it got bought by Universal Pictures, Ned Tannen, for the movies. I sold it on the condition that I write the screenplay.
Oh.
And since I was already a screenwriter and had a couple of movies to my credit, they said, okay. I worked with Herb Ross, who was the director, and I had a great, fun, exhilarating experience making the movie. I learned a lot because I wanted to direct, and I went on to direct Time After Time, mm-hmm. and Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and a whole bunch of I wrote a couple of Philip Roth movies. I wrote two more Star Trek movies and directed Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. A lot of stuff came out of that, from hanging on this around the set and so forth. And what I learned was that movies are different than plays and novels. They are image-centric as opposed to word-centric. And I was not entirely successful in eliminating the number of words. It's a very talky script. The fact that it got nominated for an Oscar, the screenplay, is sort of ironic. It's sweet in retrospect that I got an Oscar nomination. And you can say in defense of the wordiness that, well, at least it's smart words. You know, you can get off listening and say, because you feel smarter watching the movie.
Sure.
The movie makes you feel smart. Good. But what I was to learn over the years of making films is that the attrition rate for dialogue in a screenplay by me between the first draft of the script and the finished film is about 50%.
Really?
50% of the words are going to go. The question is, where are they going to go? Are they going to go when you're writing it, which is the least expensive place to lose them, or in the editing room, which is the most expensive place to lose them? And Herb Ross was very, very faithful to my screenplay. And every time I tried to get him to cut things out, can you imagine the author begging the director to cut words out and the director saying, no, 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 we have to have this. Yeah, it's never happened before or since. I was begging him, just saying, you know, we really don't need this. Look what the actor's doing. You know, it says it with a look and so forth. So it was a very interesting experience. I also felt that what was really great about the novel, the thing I liked best, and I should say artists are not the best judges of their own work. So this is just one man's opinion at this point. I loved Holmes meets Freud. I loved how we got them there. I thought the mystery that they collaborate on in the second half of the book was not as good as it could have been. I don't know that I'm the greatest mystery writer around, but I thought, could I take the movie as an opportunity to improve on the book, to get another whack at it, take another bite of the apple, however you want to phrase it, and see if I could improve it? And there was another motive for this, and that is that if you read a best-selling novel that's a mystery story, you come to the end and you know who done it. So when you go to the movie version of it, you already know. When I went to see Presumed Innocent, I had read the book, so I knew who done it.
Sure.
So the element of surprise was not there. So I thought, well, wait a minute. If I change the story a little bit in the movie of the 7% solution, I can preserve the central conceit of the story. Holmes and Freud team up, but no one's going to be able to sit back and relax because they know what's coming, because they won't. So that was how I, you know, in broad strokes, writing the screenplay and what I learned and the struggles that I encountered with the words. But as far as working with Olivier, I think a lot of people nowadays don't realize who Laurence Olivier was. He was the English Marlon Brando. That's the short version of it. An amazingly exciting actor and director. You should see that Henry V movie sometime, or his Hamlet, or his Richard III, and see him when he was a young guy in Wuthering Heights, as opposed to, you know, he grew old and he played all these character roles. And when Herb Ross said to me, what do you think about Laurence Olivier to play Professor Moriarty? And I'm thinking, act cool, be grown up. We're grown up people. We're making a grown up movie. But inside I'm going, ah. I'm saying, really? Oh, yeah. I guess that sounds kind of right. Yeah, no. Yeah, sure. Why not? You know. And then I thought, you're never going to live to meet him, you know, because it was like 6 months away before we were going to shoot.
Right.
He's never going to live to see you, and this is never going to happen. And then somehow, there we are at the Pinewood Studios outside London. And Herb says, you know, Lord Olivier, he said, just call me Larry, but he was Lord Olivier by that time. This is Nicholas Meyer, the author. And in fact, I had a little correspondence with him that he had forgotten, perhaps understandably. I'm sure he gets a lot of fan letters. But I had seen his movie of, it was either The Three Sisters or The Cherry Orchard. He made a movie, directed it, and was in it. And it was the first time I really understood why Chekhov was great. And I had written him a letter. And I was like 25 years old or something. And I said, I'm trying to be a writer. I have this novel coming out that I wrote. I would be happy to send you a copy. And he wrote back a very sort of pro forma, thank you very much for your letter. I'm so glad you liked the movie. That was best. Good luck with your stuff. That was it, which of course I had framed. Framed.
Absolutely.
And now meeting him on the thing at Pinewood, he's going to be in the movie. He's going to be speaking, you know, Shakespeare and Nick Meyer's dialogue. You know, life is just hilarious. I mean, unbelievable. And I said, do you remember this letter? He said, no. He said, and he said something about, yeah, we didn't get a lot of mail after that movie. I guess, you know, like three people saw the Chekhov movie, and I apparently was one of them. And I was quite overcome by it, actually, being the sort of geek that I suppose I am. Anyway, and then I said, well, I offered you a copy of the book. You know, would you like a copy? I've got one here. So what was the guy going to say? He said, oh, I would be thrilled, my boy. So I, you know, inscribed it. And I said, to Laurence Olivier, whose art has taught me so much about life, too little payment for so great a debt. That's from The Taming of the Shrew for your information. Anyway, I gave him the book. And he was on the movie for 3 days. And for 3 days, I was floating on air. Then he left, and I went into a profound depression. I was so blue. But I used to have lunch with him every day in the commissary. And at one point, he said to me, talking about Holmes, he said, you know, did he really take cocaine? I said, well, yes, he did. And he said, oh, I don't think my father let me read that one.
That's good stuff. Wow, Nick. No, thank you so much. I would love to discuss The Day After. So,
okay.
Yes, sir. So this was released in 1983, deals with the question of a nuclear exchange. If I don't miss my mark, it set a record as the highest rated television film in history at the time.
And not in history at the time. Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
It's the highest rated television movie of all time.
Uh-huh.
The end. It's 100 million people watched this movie in one night. And that's a number that will never be equal because there's too many channels. So,
Sure. You win. The end of the story, book is closed. What was it like directing that movie? And yes, I got to ask you if you were surprised at all by the success of it, the massive success of it.
I was astounded by the success of it. Just to recap for your listeners.
Yeah.
The Day After was a television movie that aired in 1983. And in that movie, you see a nuclear war between the United States and the then Soviet Union. It is not shown from the point of view of politicians or Washington or Moscow. It's not shown from the point of view of the military in any way. It's just shown from the point of view of people like us, people watching the tube, people going about their lives, about to get married, shopping, going to college, whatever, and everybody gets nuked.
Yeah.
And the way it happens is the way it will happen. You will never know who hit you with a nuke or why. You'll just be fried. That's it. Or if you're really unlucky, you'll live to die of radiation sickness. It's not a happy movie. It had been offered. This was ABC. There were only three networks at the time, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And ABC, for complicated reasons, decided to make this movie, or rather one executive, a man named Brandon Stoddard, decided he wanted this movie made. And he had to threaten to resign to get the damn thing on the air.
Wow.
Because nobody at ABC or anywhere else wanted this movie. They knew that all the sponsors would run away. The function of commercial television is to sell products, is to advertise. And by the time this puppy went on the air, there were no sponsors. General Motors, General Mills, General Foods, all the generals had headed for the hills. I was the third director to be offered it. I was coming off Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. In those days, it was considered a step down if you went from directing feature films to directing television. And I was at the time being psychoanalyzed. I was trying to figure out getting my together and all kinds of different stuff. And I was lying on the couch, which is what you do in formal psychoanalysis, and trying to rationalize my way out of making a movie about nuclear war. Who wanted to think about this? Nobody wants to think about it, right, including me. I was having fun. I was being a successful writer, film director. I was meeting girls. This was all good. And my shrink, who never spoke, you do all the heavy lifting in psychoanalysis. They may play back some of what you say and reorder it a little bit and say, today you seem to be talking about, but he's not a guru. He doesn't give advice. So I was very startled when he suddenly said, well, I think this is where we find out who you really are.
Hmm.
Checkmate. I had to do the movie. That's how I wound up doing it. And there's a new documentary out that you can probably find here and there called Television Event. That's the name of the movie, Television Event, which is a documentary about the making of The Day After, which barely got on the air. I wondered if my career was, I was going to be blacklisted because William Buckley and Phyllis Schlafly, some of your listeners may know those names, ran up and down the country like Chicken Little saying the sky was falling and that I was a communist if we made this movie about nuclear war and we were doing a disservice to our own nuclear arsenal, blah, blah, blah. Like we, that nuclear bombs are so helpful. And so the end result was that the movie became this hot button controversy. And by the way, I think without that controversy, it wouldn't have been so successful. I think there's nothing like being banned in Boston before people, you know, the moment somebody says, don't read this book.
Right.
Don't watch this movie. Condemned by the Catholic Legion of Decency. Boy, that's like the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. So I remember that it was on in October or November of 83, I can't remember. And I was sitting there with my fiance watching this thing. There was no commercials. I think Orville Redenbacher popcorn was the only guy who bought time on it, and only in the first half, because once the bomb started flying, no, didn't stop. And I said to her, honey, if this weren't my movie, do you think you'd be sitting through this? This is so upsetting. And by the way, I've seen it since, and it's still upsetting. It's terrifying. Are there more graphic depictions? You bet. There's a British movie called Threads that's way worse. But Threads wouldn't have made it on TV. It's just on American TV. It wouldn't have happened. So I woke up the next morning, and they told me that 100 million people had watched this thing. Could have knocked me over with a feather. It was certainly the last thing I expected.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. I crave your indulgence for a minute, Nick, because there's a historical tie-in I want to make here and perhaps get your thoughts on. If my information was right. So in 1987, Reagan and Gorbachev signed the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and that resulted in the banning and reducing of their nuclear arsenal. In Reagan's memoirs, Reagan evidently drew a direct line from the film to the signing. And my question is, what was it like to have a real and true effect on history for the better?
The short answer is that sending Reagan to Reykjavik to meet Gorbachev and sign the missile treaty, which, by the way, is the only treaty that ever resulted in the actual dismantling of nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Is undoubtedly the most worthwhile thing to date that I've ever gotten to do with my life. There's, you know, man, I got a few good years left. Who the hell knows what's going to happen? But certainly in terms of something worthwhile, something important. But at the time, and there's numerous sources besides Ronald Reagan's memoir that draws the connection between he came to office believing in a winnable nuclear war. And with, you know, his advisor said, yes, 20 million dead, an acceptable, you know, loss. Obviously, no one knows what they're even saying when they say 20 million dead is an acceptable loss.
Right.
And there's a saying that one picture is worth 1,000 words. And when he saw the movie and his biographer, Edmund Morris, was living in the White House at the time he saw the movie, and I adapted an Edmund Morris biography of Teddy Roosevelt for Martin Scorsese. Mm-hmm. So I met with Edmund Morris, who described not only in his Reagan biography, which is called Dutch, but also verbally to me that Reagan flipped out when he saw the movie. He said it was the only time in the 3 years that he lived in the White House that he saw this guy totally lose his. And as I say, he believed in a winnable. He met with the nuclear Australian activist, Dr. Helen Caldicott, in the White House. This is before he saw the movie. And he told her that the missiles could always be recalled. And she astonished him by saying, no, they can't. They can't be recalled. He had been watching, you know, Dr. Strangelove.
Right.
And thought that it was like a bomber. It could be recalled if you had the recall code. Incidentally, when he got to the White House, Ronald Reagan wanted to be shown the war room. And people had to say to him, Mr. President, there is no war room. And he said, what do you mean? You know, I saw it in the movie. And that was the set from Stanley Kubrick's movie. Steven Spielberg said it was the greatest movie set ever built, is the war room from Dr. Strangelove. That's what he thought it was. And it wasn't just Ronald Reagan who was really shaken up by the movie. There was a general on Castro's staff who, having seen the movie, said that the Cuban Missile Crisis had not been real to him until he saw the movie.
Huh.
And they showed the movie in Russia at the time also, because the movie never says who started the war. That wasn't the point. This wasn't a finger-pointing political exercise. This was a movie that simply said, if you have a nuclear war, this is what it's going to be like on a good day, by the way. It wasn't the Threads version of it. It wasn't the worst version of nuclear war. And I don't think we knew about nuclear winter at the time we made it. So it isn't the worst version. It's the version that I made that was designed not to be so impossible to watch that people would reach for the remote control and switch to something else. Because that remote thing, man, if you don't like it, it's thumbs up, thumbs down, go to the next show.
The ultimate judge.
You had to walk a kind of a fine line.
Yeah. Yeah. Understood, Nick. Switching it a little bit, I'm very curious. What was it like directing Tom Hanks and John Candy in Volunteers, released 1985 for our listeners?
Well, it was a great antidote.
Yeah.
I mentioned before that I watched The Day After with my fiance, and I was on my honeymoon in 1984 when I read the screenplay for Volunteers, and it made me laugh. And I thought, and Tom and John Candy were already cast in it. And I thought, well, this looks like a lot of fun. And it was. I had a good time. Maybe I had too good a time. I thought that anything that made me laugh was okay to put in the movie. And maybe some of the things that are in the movie don't properly belong in the film, you know, sort of silly things. But it was a lot of fun. I remember that when we rehearsed the scene between when Tom Hanks and John Candy first meet, and they meet in an airplane, seated next to each other on their way to join the Peace Corps in Thailand. And we rehearsed the scene with two folding chairs in a room in L.A., and Tom could not get through the scene without laughing at John Candy. Couldn't get through it. And I thought, well, by the time we're in Mexico, which is where we shot the movie, which is like, you know, 4 months down the road, you know, that will be all right. But there we were 4 months later, sitting in a Pan Am jet on the tarmac, and he still couldn't get through. I wanted to do it in one shot, and I couldn't. I had to go close-ups because Tom couldn't watch John Candy do his dick. And he was like biting the inside of his cheeks because he was supposed to just be looking at him deadpan. He had a hard time with that. That's also where Tom met his wife, because I cast Rita Wilson in the movie, and they lived happily ever after.
Still married to this day.
Yes. It was the last time I looked.
Yeah. So as you gleaned out a little bit earlier, Nick, you directed a bunch of the Star Trek movies. I've seen you in other interviews saying that you couldn't really call yourself a fan of the show. How is it that you came
to
direct?
For the simple reason that I'd never seen the show.
Yeah, decent enough reason to me. How was it then that you came to direct those films, and what was the experience like?
After Time After Time, which was my first writing directing thing, was Malcolm McDowell and Mary Steenburgen and David Warner, Jack the Ripper versus H.G. Wells, time travel. There was a movie I wanted to make really badly, a screenplay I'd written based on a novel, and nobody was interested in doing this. And I was sort of digging in my heels and saying, this is what I want to do. And if you don't want to do this, leave me alone. And a friend of mine said, Nicky, if you want to learn how to direct movies, you should go out and direct and not be sitting up here in your house holding your breath or something. And I guess this was good advice. And my friend was then an executive at Paramount. Her name was Karen Moore. And she said, why don't you come down and meet Harve Bennett, the producer of Mod Squad and $6 Million Man and Rich Man, Poor Man, first miniseries, I think. He's been assigned to produce the second Star Trek movie. And I think you guys would get along. And so I had not really seen Star Trek when it was on TV and I was in college. I would catch glimpses of it and it just looked dopey to me. And I thought the costumes were silly and the sets looked cheesy. And I didn't get the man with the pointy ears and I just kept going. Speaking of the remote clicker, but I went down and met Harve Bennett and I did in fact really get along and like Harve a lot. And so he showed me the Star Trek movie, Star Trek, the motion picture. He showed me some episodes and I said, well, this looks kind of could be fun. It reminded me of something that I really liked, which was a series of books that I read when I was about 15 and reading those Sherlock Holmes books about Captain Horatio Hornblower. And Captain Hornblower was a captain in the Royal Navy during the Napoleonic Wars. And he had lots of adventures. And he had a girl in every port. And that sounded, you know, cool to a 14-year-old, whatever.
Sure.
And I thought, so this Star Trek thing is sort of like Hornblower in outer space. And if you've grown up watching Errol Flynn as Captain Blood or the Seahawk, you thought, oh, okay, fine. I could do Hornblower in outer space. Submarines, destroyers. I had seen the Nautilus in 20,000 Leagues. I told you that earlier. Yeah, you know, and Harve said, draft 5 is coming in a couple of weeks, and I'll send you the script. So I said, great. And then I didn't hear from him. And I woke up, it was a month later. I said, well, whatever happened to that Star Trek thing I was jonesing for? My space opera. And I'd seen Star Wars by that time, and I'd heard the John Williams score, and I thought, wow, this is whatever. And so he said, oh, I'm embarrassed. He said, it isn't good. I can't show it to you. His description was more vivid than that, but I'll spare you. And I said, well, what about draft 4, draft 3? And he said, kid, he always called me kid, you don't get it. All these 5 drafts are simply separate attempts to get another Star Trek movie. Because whatever you thought of the first Star Trek movie, and by the way, I don't knock it, because someone had to go boldly where no one had gone before. And so I don't put it down. And he said, these are just, that movie made money. So we're going to make another one way or the other. We're going to do it. So I said, well, why don't you send me all 5 scripts? Let me read them. So he said, really? And I said, yeah. And in those days, you didn't hit send on a computer. A van drove up. And it wasn't just 5 scripts. You know, it was like all the different whatever. And I told you I'm a slow reader. And I sat down and I read all these scripts slowly. And then I said to Harve and his producing partner, Robert Salen, I said, why don't we make a list? Why don't we take a yellow legal pad and make a list of everything that we like in these 5 different scripts. A major plot, a subplot, a sequence, a scene, a line of dialogue, a character, doesn't matter. We just make this list. And then I will try to see if I can combine all the things we like into a new script. And then we'll have something we can shoot. And they said, well, problem is that the special effects house that's responsible for the special effects in the movie, which was George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic is the name of the company. They say that if we don't have a screenplay in 12 days, we cannot guarantee delivery of the shots in time for the June opening of the movie.
Wow.
And I said, what June opening? I'd only directed one movie. I don't know how this worked. And they said, yeah, we booked the movie into theaters in, you know, June, whatever it was. I said, you booked the movie into theaters and you don't have a movie? And he said, well, that's the way it's always done. I said, oh, well, I said, if we make the list now, I'll try to give you a script in 12 days. And they still didn't look happy. And I said, what's wrong with that? And they said, well, we couldn't even make your deal in 12 days. And then I said, look, forget my deal, forget the credit, forget the money. We're not talking about directing. That deal is in place. But if we don't do this right now, there's not going to be a Star Trek movie. Now, are we making this list or we're not? So we, you know, they looked at me like I was crazy, and my agent wanted to kill me when I told him. But we said, okay, we picked Khan as a good villain. We picked the Genesis Project. We picked Kirk Meets His Son. We picked Lieutenant Savick. You know, those are the things we picked, or with the Mutara Nebula, whatever. And these different, and the simulator scene was in draft 3 or 4, and it was on page 25, and Spock wasn't in it or anything like that. But these were the things I was grabbing at and fiddling with like a Rubik's Cube for 12 days, of which I have no recollection, except that my back went out at the end of it from sitting at this typewriter.
Wow.
And it was a Smith Corona portable electric. And I wrote most of the dialogues, all mine. Harv wrote some lines, you know, would you care for a tranquilizer? And the captain, this is the garden spot of CD Alpha.
Yeah.
Yeah. But mainly it was my dialogue with a little help from Shakespeare and Herman Melville, because that was free. And that's how it got written.
Wow. That's wonderful, Nick. I have just a couple questions left, Nick. Is that okay?
Yeah, I can give you 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. I'll be brisk. I appreciate it. So in 1988, you directed The Deceiver with Pierce Brosnan. And I'd love to know, what was it that made you choose to direct that particular project?
The long answer, which seems the only thing I give are long answers, is that the second Sherlock Holmes story, The Sign of the Four, is the background to that story is the great mutiny of 1857 in India. And in a couple of short pages, Arthur Conan Doyle fascinated me with the Indian mutiny, the Raj, the British in India, all that. And, you know, then I saw that Gunga Din movie when I was a kid with Cary Grant and all. And so India fascinated me. And I started to read, there were several novels written by an Englishman who served in the British Army in India. This was before Indian independence, whose name was John Masters. And John Masters, he had written another book called Bhowani Junction that had been made into a movie by George Cukor in Pakistan, substituting for India. And I love John Masters, and I still do. And one of his great books was the Night Runners of Bengal. And I had actually read The Deceivers. I knew this book. So when Ismail Merchant and Merchant Ivory got around to asking, you know, was somebody interested in directing this? And by the way, you know, the script ends with a cavalry charge.
Yes.
Are you kidding me? We're going to India, you know, and I had a 9-month-old kid, and people said to my wife, don't take your kid to India. And she said, why not? They got lots of kids there. So, so off we went to India and had the time of our lives making that movie with Pierce, and Pierce and I stayed friends to this day.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. He's a wonderful man. And it was a big adventure. And I had a great time. I'm not sure. Well, I am sure that under Modi, I'm not sure what India is like today. But
right.
Anyway, and there's no question it's a country with a great many problems. But I think all countries at this point have a great many problems. Reading that the Colorado River is running dry and wondering where my next glass of water is coming from.
Right.
Anyway, but there we were. And my wife said, you can make the movie. We'll go to India on one condition. She said, I have to ride in the cavalry charge.
That's great.
She was from Kentucky. She used to train steeplechasers. So she rode in the cavalry charge.
One question I know I'll kick myself if I don't ask you before we end our time together is, what made you want to write the screenplay for The Prince of Egypt?
Well, the offer. The offer. Jeffrey Katzenberg was now at DreamWorks, and this was going to be their first animated film. And Jeffrey had been in charge of animation over at Disney, and they had done The Little Mermaid and Aladdin and all that. So he wanted to do an animated movie, and they decided to, you know, to do it the animated Ten Commandments. And funnily enough, Jeffrey and I had gone to the same high school. So he had some glancing familiarity. He must have known about the 7% solution because a lot of people knew. Anyway, he offered me to work on it. And I said, okay, because I had seen the Ten Commandments a million times. And I thought, oh, maybe I should read the book. So I read the first five books of Moses in the Old Testament. And I thought, oh, this is a really good story. And by the way, it turns out that Moses is a murderer. And we were sitting, big story conference. I said, does anybody know or care that Moses is a murderer? I mean, that's like a cool thing. You have a flawed hero.
Yeah.
He could be in search of redemption and a lot of possibilities. And there's that dead silence. And I said, he's a murderer? Who does he murder? And I says, well, in the book, it says that he kills an Egyptian overseer. More silence. And I said, oh, wait. The Egyptian overseer is beating a slave. And it's a crime of, and somebody said, no, not just the slave, his mother.
Mm.
And they go, oh, that sounds so, yes, crime of passion. I said, yeah, that's not what it says in the book. In the book, it's premeditated. Bible says he looked both ways. And then when it was over, he buried the body in an earthen pit. So in the movie, the guy is beating his mother and it's a crime of passion. And the Bible wasn't good enough for them.
Excellent. Nick, I think I've taken up enough of your time, sir. I really appreciate it. How can people find out about you?
Right, which is nicholas-meyer.com, nicholas-meyer.com. You can go on Amazon and look for books by Nicholas Meyer. You can go on IMDb. You can go on the YouTube. I'm around.
You're around. Nick, thank you again so much for taking the time for me. This meant a lot. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a great weekend, okay?
You too.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.